What's good and welcome to the Hockey Mailbag, the first sports podcast run by you, the listeners. I'm your host, Brandon Rewicki, and each episode here follows a simple format. You send me whatever hockey-related questions are on your mind, and I provide the answers. If you want to be a part of the podcast, just send your questions to thehockeymailbag@gmail.com or to me on Twitter at Brandon_Rewicki. Plenty to dive on into here as we breeze past the quarter mark of the NHL season. But first, the rosters are now in for the Four Nations Tournament coming up soon. And people are fired up about that. So why don't we kick things off on today's show on that topic? And we get things underway with a question from our good friend Patty. And Patty asks, who's right when it comes down to building international best-on-best rosters? Hockey executives who have done this their whole lives, or Twitter warriors on their couches wanting every top scorer on their team? Well, thank you, Patty, for the very unbiased question there. I wonder which way you're leaning on this topic, but I appreciate throwing this one our way. And I'm assuming this is a little more geared towards the Canadian and the American rosters. It seemed like everything was, for the most part, pretty set with Team Sweden and Team Finland there. Look, I wish, actually, I don't know if I wish, but I would say this. I'm not a hot take merchant. I like to be a little bit more reasoned and logical with my thinking. At least I like to think so. And so, you know, it might be a bit boring of an answer, but I really think the truth lies somewhere in the middle between the way hockey executives have kind of typically built these teams and the way a lot of fans would like to see these teams stack up. Because, look, there certainly is, I think, some overthinking when it comes to how the teams are actually built in terms of maybe a little bit leaning too heavily or putting too many assets, too many players towards the intangible, the roster fit and things like that. Like, sometimes I do think teams get a little bit too carried away. But I would also agree that fans lean too heavily towards the pendulum of, who are the top 10 point producers up front? Okay, those forwards make the team. We'll figure the rest out because they're awesome players. It really isn't that easy, right? When you look at Team Canada, for example, and maybe where some of the consternation comes from here, it would certainly be centered around the bottom of the forward roster and then the Parayko and Sanheim decisions on the back end there. I would say this, though, for people worried that Canada went too intangible heavy or too focused on bringing in grinders and things like that on their third and fourth lines. Travis Konecny is seventh in Canadian scoring right now. Brandon Hagel is eighth in Canadian scoring amongst forwards. They're both on pace for 100 points this year. It's not like Team Canada brought Rob Zamener and Chris Draper back from the hockey graveyard here to fill in roles on the bottom line here. Like they're bringing in legitimate studs to kind of fill in their third and fourth lines here. Anthony Cirelli has been lights out for Tampa Bay this year. He's a point-a-game player, not getting top power play minutes, and going up against, as a shutdown role, the top opposition night in, night out for the Lightning. And even Sam Bennett. You know, Sam Bennett's a point-a-game player this year for the defending champs. And he's been great in the playoffs the past 2 years. So, like, yeah, I mean, look, did they take guys that maybe have a little more pizzazz to their name? No, they pass on the Scheiflies and the Tavareses and a few other guys there. I actually don't mind the way the forward group looks right now. And the other part of this too is, and this goes for the U.S. in a sense as well, but like, look, McDavid, McKinnon, you have them on your roster. You're going to play them at least 20 minutes a night, each of them, on their own line. That takes up 40 of the 60 minutes right there. There's not a whole lot of minutes to go around after that. And so if Braden Point on the third line is going to get an extra 12, 13, 14 minutes, you're talking about a handful of shifts a game that the fourth line is going to get. Maybe there's some value there in having Sam Bennett as a bit of a nuclear bomb ready to send Quinn Hughes into next week or taking a run at one of the Tkachuk brothers, right? Like I can kind of understand it from that point there where, you know what? It's a lot easier to sell a role to a guy like that than it might be to somebody that plays 22 minutes a night on their NHL team on a nightly basis. So I the forward group, I don't mind. The back end, I mean, you could maybe understand a little bit of debate to be had there. But I'll tell you what, Canada was up 2-1 against the Americans with 40 seconds left. I'm not going to mind having a freaking giraffe, rhinoceros hybrid, and Colton Parayko out there blocking half the ice as opposed to maybe Evan Bouchard in that situation. So I do ultimately kind of lean a little bit more towards how the hockey execs have gone about doing this. I will say this, though, for Team USA, I think they could have been a little bit more aggressive in terms of bringing some of the high-end talent that they have. I would have found a spot for Tage Thompson on my team. I'll tell you that much. He is really one of a kind in the hockey world right now. And even as a 13th forward, like to kind of throw him in as a bit of a wild card if things get rocky for the U.S., I don't know if I would have passed up on that opportunity. But for the most part, I actually think the GMs built themselves some pretty good teams. But thanks for the question either way, Patty, there. An interesting topic to dive into to get things started here. We'll continue with the Four Nations talk with a question from Don Geo. And Don Geo asks, are people actually going to watch this thing? Well, thanks. I guess, Don Geo, the answer would depend on what your definition of people is. And I don't mean just, you know, humans. But the reason I say that is, are hockey fans going to watch this? Yes, absolutely they're going to. Most will complain and say it's a gimmick and that it doesn't matter. But they'll all watch it, as hockey fans are wont to do. But I think the intriguing question that you bring up there is, will the non-hockey fan go out of their way to consume this, right? Like, how much of a dent will this make in the American sports scene? Because a lot of Canadians are going to consume this regardless, right? But can you actually get a large chunk of the non-hockey watching population to tune into this? And my prediction for that is, I think the NHL's lucky if this makes a ripple. I think this was a bit of a missed opportunity by the league here with the way that they designed this tournament. Because as it stands right now, the average sports fan who doesn't watch hockey on a regular basis has never heard about this before. When it starts to run, will likely have never heard about it and not even be aware that it's on. And I guess most importantly, what's the compelling reason for them to watch it? Like, what's the storyline there, right? Hockey fans get it. They're excited. We haven't seen best on best in forever. But for the average person that doesn't watch the sport, oh, wow, some random tournament is coming up in the middle of the season. And it's not even the Olympics or anything like that. Like, there's no real big draw there that's going to grab the attention, I think, of the general public. I have kind of maintained from the beginning that I think the NHL made a major, major misstep in this. And I think that the move 1,000% would have been, with all due respect to the great hockey nations of Sweden and Finland, but if you weren't going to make this a true best on best with every country in the world participating, why not take a page out of the Summit Series playbook and just turn this into, in terms of marketing talk, the battle for supremacy in the hockey world. Team Canada versus Team USA, best of five series, winner takes all. Because, I mean, as far as Canadians go, you know, I'm not going to speak for Americans, but some of our most fondest hockey memories, you ask the average Canadian, you know, what was the best hockey that's ever been played, right? And a lot of them will say it's the 72 Summit Series and it's the 87 Canada Cup. Hockey was never better than those two tournaments. Well, guess what? I mean, the Summit Series easily had this, right, with the series between Canada and the USSR. But even again, you know, the Soviet Union facing Canada in a best of three final, there is so much more drama and stakes to be had there when you have the same teams going head to head like that. And at the time, those were the biggest rivals, right? It was Canada and Russia, like the two biggest powers in hockey on the planet. And it made for tremendous hockey, tremendous TV, tremendous drama. And I think there was a big opportunity, man, to put that in place here for the hockey world, where you have the young, plucky Americans finally catching up with the Canadians in terms of talent. And then the Canadians trying to defend that crown of being number one in the hockey world. I think it would have been outstanding. I think by game 3, 4, 5, it would have been must-watch TV. And that's how you kind of grab the attention, you know, make it a bit of a patriotic battle, right, between these two countries. That's how you grab the attention of the general public there, where it becomes a bit of a pride thing. And then they get sucked into the immense talent and skill that's on display. So I really don't think we're going to see great numbers come out of this for the NHL. I don't know that they're necessarily expecting that either. But man, oh man, you could. I really think a big time opportunity was thrown away here, because who wouldn't be watching this to see Canada versus the U.S.? Especially imagine if it was a winner take all game 5. You know what I mean? Like that would have been the number one sport highlight to kick off SportsCenter. Even with the NBA going on and anything else going on in the NFL offseason, that would have been the number one thing. I don't think that's going to be the case, even if Canada and USA make the Four Nations final there. But thank you for the question, Don Geo. Got to get a little off my chest there. And one final one here. I mean, this was, I got a dozen of these, so I can't even give a shout out to a specific name here. But just a few questions on who ultimately is going to win this tournament. Who's your pick to win the Four Nations? What's fascinating to me about this, I mean, look, don't discount Sweden. Finland's going to be a tough out. I'm not going to be shocked if we see the Swedes make it to the final game. But talking specifically about Canada versus the U.S., the most fascinating thing to me about this whole thing is the championship pedigree between the two teams and how that might come into play. I don't know. It's a spidey sense. Maybe it's a part of me as a Canadian being a little bit scared of the Americans, looking pretty nasty. But Team Canada brings 17 of 23 players that have won the Stanley Cup before. Team USA only has 4 players that have won the Stanley Cup before. And a lot of those Americans haven't had deep playoff success either, looking at you, Austin Matthews. So I just kind of wonder, when you get into the stakes like this and you have a little bit more of a battle-hardened, veteran-laden, championship-type team in Team Canada, if maybe there's a little bit more composure their way when they go up against the U.S. And I would say the goaltending disparity, yes, it's heavy in Team USA's favor. No doubt about that. But guess what? They can only play one goalie at a time. So, like, great, you have a better second and third goalie, but kind of means diddly squat when the game's going on. But I think Binnington's a lot better than people are kind of giving him credit for. He's no Hellebuck, don't get me wrong, but I'm going to say that having the 3 best players on the planet is enough to allow the Canadians to maintain their perch atop the hockey world, and I'll take Team Canada once again to win a best-on-best international tournament. But thank you for the questions on that, and now we will switch over to the actual NHL regular season now. And to kick things off, in terms of talking a little NHL 2024, soon to be 2025, we go to Earl the Pearl. Nice. I'm assuming this is NBA Hall of Famer Earl the Pearl Monroe. So thanks, Mr. Monroe. But Earl asks, now that we've passed American Thanksgiving, name one playoff team that is in the playoff bubble that will fall out, and one team outside the line that will find their way in. Interesting question, Earl. There's some obvious answers here, which kind of makes this a little bit upsetting in terms of, you know, me trying to amp up a little bit of drama. But I'll try to do you one better. I'll do one from the East and one from the West for both of those, okay? And so a team that is currently in that will fall out, I mean, the West is an easy one. It's going to be the Calgary Flames. I think Flames fans would agree with that and actually want it to happen. Although, if it knocks Edmonton out, I take that back. But ultimately, there's just not enough firepower there for Calgary to keep up with the Edmontons and the Colorados. But they got their goalie of the future. Dustin Wolf's a hell of a tendy, so that's great. I'll take Calgary to fall out in the West. I will say this. I'm a little scared about the Winnipeg Jets right now. I'm not going to pick them to fall out of the picture entirely, but they're dealing with a lot of adversity, some untimely injuries, a brutal schedule right now. I'm just saying, keep an eye out for the Winnipeg Jets, but hopefully they're able to right the ship there and keep things going. But I'll take the Flames out West. I got to go with the Rangers in the East, which is crazy to say. I mean, I might take the Rangers. The Rangers and the Flyers, as of this recording, are both in the playoff picture. For those that might not remember from previous episodes, I am a diehard Flyers fan. Kind of hard to envision the Flyers finding a way to maintain their pace and get into the playoffs. But I'm going to focus on the Rangers here a little bit because they are dead last in a stat that I've just made up, which is vibes per 60. The vibes are not good in that New York Rangers locker room right now. And I've actually caught their last three or four games, including one against the Flyers where Philly won. And they look flat out awful. Like I was blown away. This was not the team that won the President's Trophy last year. It's a team that doesn't even look all that interested in competing right now. And I don't really know how they get out of this funk because you have a captain who is a complete malcontent at the moment, who doesn't want to be traded. The team's trying to trade him. He's not happy. He's not playing well either. Neither is Keandre Miller on the second pair. And then you've got a forward group that's completely underwhelming at the moment. And Artemi Panarin is now, what is he? Now he's just all-star level instead of potential Hart Trophy level, right? Like there's a lot of factors going on right there with the Rangers. And Shesterkin has done his part. If not for him, they would be completely out of the playoff picture at the moment right now. I just don't know if there's an easy fix with New York because I don't think Chris Drury's going to fire Laviolette because I don't think Chris Drury's going to get to fire another coach without him getting the axe as well. It seems like it might just be one of those seasons with New York. And I don't know. Their big thing has always been to me the Mika Zibanejad problem where he's a good centerman. But is he ultimately going to be the number one centerman on a Stanley Cup winning team? I don't think he is. And if you believe that, how do you improve on that? It's pretty much impossible, right? Unless you can find a GM out there who's a big Zibanejad fan, who's also got a number one center that he's willing to move, right? And I just don't know if you're going to find that specific combo for the Rangers at this time. So I'll get a little ballsy, and I'll say the Rangers fall out of the mix. As far as teams that come in, in the East, I think the easy one there is Tampa Bay, just a point back of both the Rangers and the Flyers there. I think Tampa's played some decent hockey too. Maybe been a little bit unlucky in terms of results in some of those games. But I think ultimately Tampa Bay finds a way to turn things around. I don't like the East at all. There's the teams outside the playoff picture are gnarly right now. I almost wanted to say the Islanders, but yeah, I'm not going to be too crazy with that. Out West, I mean, Edmonton outside the playoff picture, they're going to get in. I think they're going to do so comfortably as well. I'll say this, don't completely shut out the possibility of Utah making things interesting. Their underlying numbers are pretty juicy right now. And Cooley's taking a bit of a step. Vemelka's playing good between the pipes right now. The injuries on the blue line have really, really put a dent in this team. But if they can maybe get a little bit healthier there by the second half, get a few other bounces to go their way. UHC ain't just done just yet. So those would be my picks for who's in, who's out after American Thanksgiving. But thanks for the question there, Earl. All right, we keep it going here. Next up, Milzy. And Milzy asks, I love the way this is worded, by the way, Milzy. But Milzy says, Buffalo, Ottawa, and Detroit are at it again. What do they do this time? It's really, I would say it's sad as a hockey fan that with how poor Boston and a bunch of the Metro have been to start this season, there was a golden opportunity for Buffalo, Detroit, and or Ottawa to kind of officially make that push from the also-rans and get out of the lengthy rebuilds they've been in and kind of stake their spot as a playoff team this year. So I it's been upsetting to watch. I think a lot of people really feel that way too. But what do they do is, I guess, the impossible and important question here. And how much time do we got here? Can I get this done in 60 seconds? I'll see if I can answer this one in 60 seconds for you. I think it's different for all three teams. For Detroit, I think it's simple that the playoff chase last year was a bit of a mirage. And it's got to be the patient play here. You know, Seider and Edvinson look great. Lucas Raymond is still going to be a foundational piece for them up front. They've just got to wait another season, try to open a little more cap space, and then get aggressive with picks and weaponize some of those dollars in the offseason here. But at least the youth for them is kind of coming up and playing some good puck for them. With Ottawa, I think Ottawa needs to do what Washington did several years back and find their TJ Oshie. If you remember, the Capitals made a move. It was a bit of a package. It was Troy Bauer, a pick, another piece there for TJ Oshie. And that obviously was the big catalyst for them to kind of catapult them from playoff disappointment to Stanley Cup champ. Ottawa's not there yet, but I think that's the move that needs to be made. Is package a couple of your, not quite your core pieces, but maybe guys just a shade below that, and just change up the mix, change up the composition in that room. And at least that way you might get a bit of a sense of what needs to be done after that. Buffalo, I don't know, man. This is so depressing. I am not a Sabres fan, but I am so frustrated watching the Buffalo Sabres play. I mean, the answer for them might just be like, can you find a new owner? A guy that's willing to shell out and pay for this team? In the meantime, though, if that's not an option, I mean, you got $5+ million cap space. Go out there and find some players with that. I think Buffalo, more than anything, needs a little veteran stability there. I'm not a big fan of that. I think teams overpay for it. I think the Sabres kind of desperately need it. Like, they don't have a lot of guys past the age of 30 on that team. And maybe finding a good vet or two that could play, like, in the middle of your lineup to just take a little pressure off some of these guys, right? Like, I don't know. They put so much on the youngsters there in Buffalo. I just wonder if maybe a bit of a veteran hand to steady the ship might do them some good. But thanks for the question there, Millsy. We keep things moving along. Two to go before we wrap things up. Ooh, and PD21 has got a bit of a fire starter for us here. This is a question that's been going around for some time, actually. So I'm glad you brought it up. But PD21 asks, if you could draft, essentially a redraft, who you taking? At number one, Connor Bedard or Macklin Celebrini? Ooh, it is a spicy one. I do like that. I would say this right now, my kind of initial thought to that question is, now feels like the perfect time to invest in some Connor Bedard stock. I want to buy this stock while it's at an all-time low and watch that investment grow and grow. It will be my Bitcoin. I don't know anything about investing, so I don't know if that's true. But my point is, I might actually lean Bedard over Celebrini, and I'll explain why here. Even with Connor Bedard's sophomore slump to start off this season, even with his crisis of confidence, even with Chicago being hellaciously bad once again this year, he's still got 19 points in 26 games. Like, his overall game is improving. Finishing-wise, which is normally his best skill, is not there right now. And so even the floor of Connor Bedard is pretty amazing as a 19-year-old. But you know what this is kind of reminding me of? And it's easy to forget this now that he's a legendary player. Nathan MacKinnon had himself a hell of a tough start to his career. And he had that, you know, almost initial breakout campaign a la Connor Bedard. He had 63 points as an 18-year-old, which is almost the exact same as Bedard had. But his next 3 years, 38 points, 52 points, 53 points. It was not this linear explosion development path for Nathan MacKinnon. But then he figured things out by 22. And yeah, he's on pace to be an all-time legend of the game. And maybe Connor Bedard goes that route. I don't know if it's necessarily going to be as drastic, where it's like a 3-year slump sort of a thing. But I just cannot ignore the all-time scoring he put up in juniors, the greatest World Juniors performance that I've ever seen, carrying Team Canada on his back as an underager, and not think that he's going to figure things out at the NHL level and be a consistent 50-goal scorer and eventual face of this league. So I will maybe kind of swerve away from public consensus on this, as I like to do. And I'll say Bedard right now, but I will say this. Oh, Celebrini is a play. He is a bad, bad man. I was pretty high on him. There was a lot of talk going into his draft year that, he's solid defensively. Like, he's going to be great in that side of the ice. Two-way player, but will he ever have the offense at the NHL level to be a 90, 100-point guy? And I always kind of bristled at that. he's been way better than I could have imagined. I mean, San Jose is set. What a absolute home run, double decker, off the lights pick that was. He is going to be one hell of a player there. I can understand picking Celebrini, but my main point being, don't sleep on Connor Bedard. I think by the time the Olympics come around, he's going to make his case that he is he's going to be a problem for the rest of the hockey world. But thanks for the question there, PD21. And to cap things off here, this might be one of my favorite hockey questions I've ever gotten my entire life. And this one comes from T-Dot. But T-Dot asks this hypothetical, which is a beauty. I wish we could do a whole episode on this, to be honest. But T-Dot asks, choose one player all time to score on one penalty shot if your life depended on it. Who would that player be to score it? And who would the goalie be to stop it? So essentially, the biggest penalty shot in the history of mankind. And who is your pick to score and to stop that one? I absolutely love this. I wish I could give you a top 10 list of this one. I was interested in this one, so I did a little bit of research. Just because I was wondering what the statistical play is. You know what I mean? Like, just by the numbers, percentage-wise, who is the best to do it in terms of offense and then goaltending there? And I'll say this. If you ever want to stump a buddy in trivia, throw this question at them, because I pride myself on my hockey knowledge. I would never have come within a million miles of getting this one right. But the best goalie in terms of save percentage in NHL shootout history is the immortal Marc Denis. Blue Jackets legend. No one's even close to him. Andrei Vasilevskiy is kind of like the next closest one in terms of somebody that's had over 20 attempts against them. And Vasi was like a 700 save percentage, which is like amazing. Like, that puts him right really, really high up. Marc Denis stopped 35 of 41 penalty shots in his career for an 854 save percentage. The rest of my night, and it is midnight as I'm recording this, is going to be spent watching Marc Denis shootout highlights. And I will report back with my findings on what makes him so good. But that is astounding. I want to pick him just for that alone. By the way, other cool stats. Jonas Enroth once stopped 23 of 24 shootouts in one single season. And he didn't even match Marc Denis' save percent. Like, he fell off a cliff after that. Offensively, though, the greatest shootout performer of all time percentage-wise on a minimum of 10 attempts is, yep, let's all say it together here, Petteri Nummelin of the Minnesota Wild. I found out for the first time that he was an NHL player. I did not know that. But he went 8 for 10 in his career. 80%. The guy was nails. Trevor Zegras was up next at 63%, which was kind of surprising there. I do want to give a quick shout out to some shootout legends, by the way. Erik Christensen, best backhand forehand move in NHL history. And Matt Hendricks, an absolute beauty. A journeyman fourth liner. But if you want to have some fun, just YouTube Matt Hendricks paralyzer. And he's got one of the nastiest shootout moves, surprisingly, in NHL history. But who's my pick? Who would I choose all time to score a shot? And who would be my goalie to stop it? This is kind of an interesting one because it's, you know, not serendipitous. That's the wrong word. But it's very ironic that these are my two choices here. But I would say I might have to go the obvious route here. And I would go with Jonathan Toews. He's actually number one in terms of percentage over 40 attempts. Anybody that's had 40 attempts in their career, he's just ahead of TJ Oshie. So he's actually scored the most shootout goals in NHL history. But I mean, come on. Who could forget the World Junior performance? Absolutely devastating the Americans. I think he'd have to be my guy. Like, there's something about the clutch aspect that is just impossible to ignore there. And so I'd go with Jonathan Toews as my number one in between the pipes. Sorry, Marc Denis. It's got to be the Dominator. And this, I mean, look, for those that are unaware, in Canada, You could actually be fined up to $5,000 for mentioning the 98 Nagano shootout that Dominic Hasek completely shattered this nation's psyche for years and years. So we really can't talk about it all that much. But I mean, come on. He's the most unpredictable goalie in NHL history. And the fact that you don't know what he's going to do, I like that advantage over the shooters mentally. That would, I mean, just, it would be an amazing battle. Taves, Captain Canada versus the Dominator. And who would ultimately come on top in that one? I'd pay to see that. Although I would say this, there's something to be said about, you know, if Jonathan Taves was the pick there, he'd be a lot of people's pick. If it was Taves or Oshie out there, and then who comes out of the side of the rink to go in between the pipes? But Marc Denis, out of the blue. There would be some level of mental, like mental warfare going on there, where you're like, okay, they brought Denis out here for a reason. And now I'm a little bit worried about this. Like, I almost want to pick Marc Denis just for that reason alone. But the Dominator would be my pick on that. I'm going to have to try to think of who my top three would be in terms of shooters, and then maybe a goalie and a backup goalie as well. But think about that one. That's a fun topic to have a couple of cold ones with the lads and the lasses. So thanks for that one, T-Dot. And yeah, now I'm on my way to watch Marc Denis shootout mastery highlights. So that'll be how I cap off my night. And that will be how we cap off another episode of the Hockey Mailbag here. Thank you guys so much for tuning in to another episode. Really appreciate, as always, getting to hang with you beauties. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to be a part of the podcast, again, just send your questions to thehockeymailbag@gmail.com or to me on Twitter @Brandon_Rewicki. We'll be back at it later on this season, but until then, I'm your host, Brandon Rewicki, and this has been another episode of the Hockey Mailbag. Look forward to talking puck with you guys sometime soon.